This podcast is brought to you by Invesco QQQ. Anyone can become an agent of innovation. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. You can earn 4 times points on your top 2 eligible spending categories every month, like transit, U.S. restaurants, and gas stations. That's the powerful backing of American Express. 4 times points on up to $150,000 in purchases per year. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
Welcome to Trillions. I'm Joel Weber.
And I'm Eric Balchunas.
Okay, Eric, you made a call in January 2020 at Inside ETFs, and we're going to actually spend today's episode bringing the world up to speed on that call and everything that unfolded. What was your call?
Well, it wasn't a call per se. It was just I was on to an ETF that's just really having quite the breakout moment. At Inside ETFs, which is like the Comic-Con of ETFs, every year they have this best new ETF competition with all the pundits from the industry arguing for what the best launch was of the year before. So in January 2020, I argued for URNM, which is the North Shore Uranium Mining ETF. And it just came out a month ago in December 2019, so nobody heard of it. And I had looked at uranium a couple times in the 10 years prior. There's a ticker called URA, which had been around, and it's always bad. It would have a little head fake here and there, but it'd just go down again. But the story stuck with me. There was a narrative there that I was like, there's something here. And so as I've seen more people talk about ESG, it's really occurred to me that there's definitely an inconsistency between people wanting to keep up their lifestyles, yet also wanting to fight climate change. And so I was making the case on stage that URNM is A, intriguing because it launched after a horrible backtest. You never see that. And also that it was sort of like green investing for realists. You arguably are going to need to have nuclear if everybody can keep up what they're doing in their economies, and yet you can fight climate change. You just really can't get it done with solar and wind. So that's the case I made. I didn't win. I probably came in third. It's based on like how loud the audience claps. But I will say I won the performance since competition race by a mile. This thing is up 273% since then. It's up 412%. Since March 20th, right, which is a bottom for a lot of equity ETFs, that's double ARK. And everybody thinks ARK's like the best thing. That's double ARK, about 4 times the Qs. And this year, it's up 113%, which is by far the best performing equity ETF. The next best one is something like 80%. So this is a white hot area. And so I will take a little victory lap and say I was onto it early, not that I quote called it.
Okay, thanks for that explanation. So if you haven't been able to gather that yet, we're going to talk about uranium. Joining us is going to be Tim Rotolo, North Shore Indices. He's the guy who actually came out with that uranium ETF. We're also going to be joined by Michael Alkin, the CIO of Sachem Cove Partners, and John Ciampaglia, the CEO of Sprott Asset Management. This time on Trillions, nuke sanity. Tim, Michael, John, welcome to Trillions.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you very much.
Okay, so Tim, I want to start with you because uranium was your big idea. Why did you get this idea? How did it hit you?
Yeah, so I'll stop you there. I mean, it was Mike's idea. Mike was the one who he and I met in 2017, and he had written this just incredibly succinct white paper talking about, I mean, really what everybody is now talking about, big supply deficit, multi-year bear market, shrinking equity market caps, and it just made so much sense. And I've always been attracted to deeply contrarian things, and that's kind of Mike's bent. And fast forward to 2018, we had gotten involved in launching a hedge fund in the space and to invest in uranium, and it became apparent that there was this big forced seller out there, which happened to be URA, because they changed their mandate. And I looked at it and just said, if this thesis is correct, there will need to be some pure play mining ETF like there is for every other commodity, gold, silver, you know, and even rare earth metals have had an ETF that was more of a pure play. And it just looked like a really interesting entry point. And I knew nothing about ETFs at that point. So we kind of got up to speed and right time, right place, launched it in 2019, and then we're off to the races. And the whole time Mike's thesis is playing out. And literally you can go back to 2017 and look at videos that he did at conferences where he laid out the thesis. And I mean, every single point, and it, I think, you know, some of the ESG stuff was there, but the extent to which the green and the nuclear revolution, those are always kind of upside cases. But that for the thesis to work, you never actually needed any of those things. That's just kind of icing on the cake at this point. And it's been, you know, great to see this nuclear renaissance that we're kind of in the midst of beginning.
Okay, so Mike, talk to us more about that renaissance, and also what led you to sort of recognize that this was going to be this opportunity. And also, I'm really curious, you know, why has this thing basically tracked with the pandemic, right? Like, it's really popped during that time.
Yeah, Joel, sure. So my whole career has been spent on being contrarian and looking for things that people are not interested in at the time. You tend to find recency biases, and the longer the bear market, the longer the recency bias, and the more they had an anchor to it, right? So in the case of nuclear power, we had looked at it in the past in 2007. It had a big run 2011 after Fukushima. We were working on other things and didn't have time to really dive in. In 2015, though, had looked at something where the market cap of the industry had gone from about 150 billion down to about 4 billion. The number of companies had gone from maybe 500 down, you know, to 50. And so it was devastated. And so at that time, we decided it was time to dig in and just understand what the role of nuclear power is. Because as all of us, we see you talk about the greening of decarbonizing the world. That's not, it's gaining great momentum now, but it's relatively new. But even then it was starting to come around, but we know wind and solar. So what I wanted to do was understand better the role of nuclear power versus the alternatives that can help decarbonize the world. And what I realized after spending, because at that time, the sell side had disappeared. If you were a sell side uranium analyst, you were likely fired. When the commodity is down 90%, you're out of a job. And so there was really very little research, a couple of industry forecasters that were around. But I said, let's take a fresh start at this. And is there a case for nuclear power? And when you dive in and nobody's paying attention and it's just sitting there hiding in plain sight, what you realize is it's not a sexy growth business, but with draconian assumptions, it was a 1% growth business. And you realize that it's not a competitor to wind and solar. It's a complement to wind and solar. It's baseload. It's a beast. It's always on. And then as you dive in further, you say, wait a second, on a per terawatt hour of electricity generated, it's the safest form in the world of electricity generation, which most people would say, what are you talking about, right? But math is math. Facts are facts. And then there's the one thing you have to try and understand is the waste, right? We all hear, oh, nuclear waste. And again, that's a bias that exists because at the end of the day, it's really the only contained waste. You know where it goes. It sits in its cooling ponds for 5 years. It then sits in concrete steel reinforced casks sitting on the utility. So you know where that stream is. And really, then looking at that, saying, okay, it's real. Nuclear power is here to can help decarbonize the world. Eventually, the economics have to sort themselves out. It's 12% of electricity generation in the world. And at the time, the cost of the price of uranium was probably in the high teens, low 20s. And the marginal cost of production is close to 50. And so I'm not the sharpest tool in the shed, but I know that you can't pull something out of the ground at 50 and sell it at 18. That doesn't work. So you need to have supply discipline. And that was really the genesis of it. Now, where people get confused is they look at if you're in the U.S., you're in Europe, it's not a growing industry here. It's a flat to slightly declining industry. But in the developing world, it's a very rapidly growing industry. So you just have to be able to understand the differences.
All right. Well, Mike, you just went over a lot. There's a lot to unpack. And there's a couple things we're going to come back to, which is the waste, and the sentiment of having a reactor near your house. I want to get to that later in the episode. I want to just keep it to the here and now with the funds, though. And let's bring in John and talk Sprott. So we've got the URNM and URA, which track equities in the U.S. Then up in Canada, John, you have Sprott Physical Uranium Trust. Now, this actually holds yellow powder, right, in warehouses around the world, like the way gold would hold gold bars. And this fund has really sort of come out of its shell in the past couple of weeks. It's now, I believe, a billion, holds 25 million pounds of uranium, and has become a big player in the market. And recently, you had to go and ask for new shares to feed the demand. And that actually set up another a catalyst event for the whole sector. So I guess, could you talk about what you're seeing up there and how you got involved?
Sure. Thanks for having me on. So Sprott Asset Management is based in Toronto, and we often think of it as being the mine finance capital of the world. So Sprott has a very long history with all things mining. And in the last uranium cycle that happened in kind of the mid-2000s, we were very active on the equity side. And we were also very involved with the genesis of the predecessor vehicle, which was called Uranium Participation Corp. It was launched in 2005. It was a holding company structure on the Toronto Stock Exchange. And after a very long pursuit, we acquired that vehicle in July of 2021. And we converted it from a holding company structure to a more traditional investment fund. So it's a closed-end fund that trades on the Toronto Stock Exchange. It also trades on OTC Pink Sheets right now. And the reception we received with the fund has just been phenomenal. In the last couple of months, the trading volume has really picked up. The vehicle, as you said, owns about 25 million physical pounds of U308, or better known as yellow cake. And in the last, say, 6 weeks, we've acquired over 6 million pounds. As we've issued new shares in the trust, we've backed those with more physical uranium.
Help me understand 25 million pounds. Let's add 6 to it, 31. 31 million pounds. What percentage of the uranium sitting out there is that? Or is there a better way to sort of put that into context?
Sure. So right now the trust owns about 25 million. So when we acquired the company, it had about 18 and change million pounds. So we've been adding pretty consistently. So to give you some perspective, because honestly, when I first acquired the fund and tried to put it into context in my head, it's pretty mind-boggling, the amount of uranium. So we could power the entire nuclear fleet in France, which produces 70% of the country's power for 1 year with all of that material, just to give you a sense of how much uranium that is. So it's a huge quantity. It's stored at three different conversion facilities in the Western world. There's one in the U.S., one in Canada, and one in France. So that's where all these drums are residing right now.
And how did you break that news to your wife that you had just acquired 25 million pounds of uranium? How'd that go over?
Well, she thinks I'm a total geek anyway, so this just added to the legend.
Okay. Walk us through what it takes to actually, like, take possession of 25 million pounds of uranium.
Yeah, so we're accustomed to dealing with a lot of bulky commodities. We have a number of NYSE listed tickers, PHYS and PSLV. And so we're accustomed to moving around large amounts of gold and large amounts of silver. Silver in particular is very difficult to move around, but uranium is a whole other, obviously, category. It is probably the most regulated and secure supply chain of anything in the world. As you could imagine, every single pound from mine to conversion facility to nuclear reactor is tracked. So for obvious reasons. So that gives us a lot of comfort that the supply chain is very safe. And but a lot of this stuff, it moves around on ships, it moves around on trucks, and it goes from just a few places in the world. The predominant producers are in Kazakhstan, Canada, Australia, and there's a number of mines in Africa. So it's a commodity that is concentrated in only a few parts of the world, which, you know, we think that makes it more scarce and more susceptible to supply disruptions.
And do you think we will or could see one of these launched in the U.S., like a physically backed uranium ETF? I would think there'd be the iron is hot to file for one.
So part of our reorganization plan for Uranium Participation Corp was a pledge that Sprott would pursue a U.S. listing. And we're going to start that work in the coming weeks. Nobody has ever successfully launched a physical uranium stockpiling fund in the U.S. Somebody tried once, but was denied because it was more of a trading company. So we know we have a long road ahead of us in terms of working with the regulator to get approval for the new vehicle. It's something we've done many times in terms of securing SEC approval for commodity stockpiling funds. We have a lot of experience with that, and that's something we're going to be working on. It is a novel listing, so we don't really know what we're going to encounter until we're right in the thick of it.
This podcast is brought to you by Invesco QQQ. What do all the greatest innovations have in common? Agents, people who participate in progress by supporting cutting-edge ideas. Invesco QQQ is a fund that allows you access to innovators of the NASDAQ 100 all-in-one fund. So you don't have to be an inventor to help create what's next to come. Anyone can become an agent of innovation with Invesco QQQ. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. There are risks when investing in ETFs, including possible loss of money. ETF risks are similar to those of stocks. Investments in the tech sector are subject to greater risk and more volatility than more diversified investments. The NASDAQ 100 Index comprises the 100 largest non-financial companies on the NASDAQ. You can't invest directly into an index. Before investing, consider the fund's investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses. Visit Invesco.com for a prospectus containing this information. Read it carefully before investing. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
The ticker that trades OTC is SRUUF. It looks like that's starting to make its way around the Wall Street Bets crowd, the Reddit crowd. Why are they locking into this trade? Is it just because it's a place to make money, or is there some other populist motive they have?
Well, you know, at the end of the day, it really is about the thesis, you know, underpinning the story. You know, I'm not going to deny that there's probably some short-term money chasing this right now, but that's the way the market works. But I've been amazed that the growing number of investors I've spoken to that have been in the trade for the last few years. And just to step back a second, we've been working on this since 2017. So this isn't some idea we just whipped up to capture some kind of a meme following. We've been working on this for a long time because we fundamentally thought like the market needed to reset. But in the last couple of months, I've noticed a much broadening of interest. In the early days, it was a very small group of specialty investors or contrarian investors or value investors. Now I'm seeing it broaden out to generalists. They're getting interested in the story. And obviously we're seeing a lot more individual investors, which I think is great to make the market more liquid and active. And the Sprott Physical Uranium Trust is the largest vehicle of its kind in the world, and that's drawing those investors to us on both the Toronto Stock Exchange and the OTC market.
So, Mike, I want to bring it back to you because we've talked about the supply here. There is a demand question, which is obviously, you know, there's a case for more nuclear facilities, but you know, what's the outlook like for more nuclear? You mentioned the emerging world. You know, there's all kinds of policy implications, but like, what are you seeing, and what kind of timelines are these projects on?
It's a great question, Joel. So if you think about both the supply and the demand side in uranium, are very long-lived assets. It could take you take Cigar Lake, one of the biggest uranium mines in the world, owned by Cameco. It was a 30-plus year endeavor from finding it to bringing it, permitting it. Nobody wants one of these things in their backyard, right? So very long-lived, and the same thing on the demand side to plan a reactor, to get the approvals, to build it, you know, you're talking decades plus. So when you think of these things, here we are 2020, you look out to say, okay, what's 2040 look like? And the World Nuclear Association, which does a very holistic bottoms-up approach, utility by utility, to what demand look like. And in many years, they've been quite dour in their outlook. But recently, in the last few years, they've taken that outlook up. And if you just look at their recently released demand report, through 2040, you're looking at 2.6% per annum annual growth in demand for nuclear power. And that does not factor in what you can expect to see, which would be life extensions out to 80 years for many of these reactors, which many of them can get. It doesn't include small modular reactors, which are easier to build, more scalable. So you're seeing a nice growth profile, and it doesn't take a big stretch with life extensions to push up towards that 3% per annum growth, which is a very reasonable growth number.
Yeah, one comment I would add about the wind and storage, I'll give you a couple of great anecdotes of recent. So you look at the UK, in the last year, wind speeds have been lower than average. You know, that's just out of their control. So what have they had to do? Well, they had to fire up more natural gas plants, which then creates more carbon offsets that plants have to buy. And look at last February when the winter storm hit Texas. The turbines froze, the natural gas wells froze, the whole system went down at a time when electricity demand spiked. So this whole narrative about reliable baseload power, I think, is very important for electrification of the grid, and also, you know, greenhouse gas reduction targets.
Yeah, no, on the supply side, I mean, I think when I first looked at Mike's original thesis, what was so attractive is, as he pointed out, the thesis actually didn't require any nuclear demand growth. You could write it to zero. The issue is a supply issue and a marginal cost production issue, and that you need prices that are higher. And I think that's why the price and the equities have been rallying so much recently is, up until now, the demand story is kind of there, and you've had all these right sale kickers. What's been the issue is there's a supply deficit that's formed. So you don't actually have enough uranium in the world to power all these nuclear reactors. So just the demand growth that we're seeing now is just exacerbating that supply deficit. And so you need those higher prices in order to incent new mine production to fill that deficit.
So let me jump in here with that, because I get this question on Twitter a lot. Does this have room to run? And so if there's two issues going on here, one is there was a supply problem. Well, now URA is up. I'm going to use URA in this example. Sorry, Tim, because it's been around for like 12 years. URA, since inception, or since Fukushima, is down 75% still, even with that massive 200% pop. So the chart looks like a big move down and then a little dipper up. Hasn't come up to where it was. How far does it have to run just on this supply issue? Pretend there's no demand for nuclear as green energy. What's your estimate on that room to run on just the supply story?
So it depends on, you know, everyone likes to talk about where does the market balance, right? So what's the marginal cost of production? And the reality is, if you look at the four uranium cycles, it doesn't work that way, right? It's a commodity where when the price is down, to give you a little perspective, before the last cycle that really started moving in November of 2000, when it bottomed out at $7 in those dollars. For the prior several years, it had the utilities, which are by the vast majority, 99% of uranium. Because it's long-lived assets, it's long-lived mines, typically the industry, most uranium is purchased under long-term contracts, 7, 8, 9, 10 years, some longer. During the last bottom, when prices had bottomed out in the high single digits, they were contracting at about a third of their consumption per year for many, many years. You fast forward to today, since 2012 through 2021, they've been purchasing at about a third of their annual consumption. When prices start moving and requirements are uncovered into the future, they start to have more and more out into the future. In the last cycle, you saw them purchasing at 120 to 160% for many years of their annual consumption. So it's one of these things where you're looking what's the price that balances out? You know, you could say 65, 70 bucks, you could bring on the mines, but it's not that simple because you need many new mines to be built and they're not built yet. And if you look at the history of bringing uranium mines online, it's very bad. So many things can go wrong. They're in tough countries to get licenses and permits, building them. Right now, you're gonna be facing competition for equipment and people, but many of these mines need to be built. So it depends where, and you know, you think about How far could they run? It depends what price you're using. If the market balances in the 65-ish, 70 range, well, last time you were signing contracts at $90 and $100 and $110.
And just to interrupt you here, right now it's trading at about $40.
Yeah, it's trading $44.
Okay. But at Fukushima, it was what, 70, 80?
Yeah, it was Fukushima was in the low 70s, high 60s, okay. around gotcha. That time. It had peaked at 137 in June of 07. But what you're looking at, the question you have to ask is, it's a psychological battle, right? So fuel buyers have stayed out of the market for so long. And that recency bias, if you speak to them, they tell you there's all the uranium in the world that's out there, right? Well, John Cimpaglia's vehicle, which is very transparent, has given the world, the fuel buyers, 4 months to know we're coming. We're going to be buying uranium on a broker platform. Very transparently, you can go out and buy uranium to secure that uranium. And what has happened in those 4 months leading up to the launch of the At the Money offering from Sprott? Crickets. They didn't show up. They bought hardly any uranium. So for the first time in the history of uranium, John's vehicle creates daily price discovery. And what we're learning, the price has gone from 30 to 44 in a month. So what that's telling you is that all of the market's perception about all this uranium that's sitting out there is wrong. So now the question becomes is, at what price do the producers say to the utilities, sorry, we've had a decade of devastation to our share price. Now we need to make up. And then you'll see where that balances.
So that's the current state, as if there isn't this bigger picture. I want to pivot to this 10, 20 years down the road. One of the quotes I brought up on stage, I'm not sure if you were there, Tim, but when I was on stage, I brought up this Bill Gates quote from 2017 or 18, I believe. He said, nuclear is ideal for dealing with climate change because it's the only carbon-free, scalable energy source that's available 24 hours a day. Then Elon Musk weighed in about 2 months ago saying, I'm pro-nuclear. I think modern nuclear power plants are safe. Contrary to what people might think, it's possible to make extremely safe nuclear energy. And then Michael Burry from The Big Short tweeted out, if the government's going to spend $2 trillion, there's no better use than converting the U.S. to nuclear. And those are three very influential people. They seem to have come around mentally. They have access to maybe they're more curious than most people. But let's face it, there's a gap between what they say and what you'd probably find if you polled average people. They probably think of Homer Simpson, Chernobyl, deformed fish. How do you bridge that gap?
You know, you're seeing more and more. If, for instance, in the U.S., nuclear power is a bipartisan issue, right? Which it never was. It was the left versus the right. And now you're seeing this realization that if you want to decarbonize the world by 2050, as everyone is coming out proclaiming they want to do, you just have no choice. And then that opens up the conversation and people's minds to say, okay, well, let's look at some of the data. And when you look at the data, you know, we think of the movie, The China Syndrome. You think of Three Mile Island and Chernobyl, these are one-offs. And yes, scary, dangerous, but when you look at it on a per terawatt hour of electricity produced, nothing is safer. So I think that opens up people's minds. And you take those people you just mentioned, right? Bright people looking at it and saying, we get it. And I think if you look at public opinion polls, they're turning too. How long does it take 1 pound of fuel to power a light bulb, right? So coal is 2 days. Natural gas is 3 days. Nuclear is 64 years. So, I mean, when you're talking about power density and what it can really do, and then you start to realize that it's a safe fuel, and people start to really think about that.
Yeah, Eric, one other thing I would mention is the narrative shifting, also related to ESG. And obviously with COVID, ESG has grown enormously in popularity. And from many of the investors I've talked to the last few months about uranium, it's interesting that they're starting to bucket it in within this broader ESG theme, low carbon theme, electrification theme. So it's going in a bunch of different investor segments, which I think is really interesting. And I think the other point around government policy really shifting, I think you're seeing it with the Biden administration, you're seeing it in the EU. They're obviously arguing it to be in the taxonomy. And there are obviously countries like Germany that have opted to move away from nuclear. But I sit there and I look and I say, now you want to be beholden to Russian natural gas. Good luck with that.
I want to talk about one of the other challenges, and we mentioned this earlier, you know, which is the waste challenge, right? Mm-hmm. And that's a mental hurdle that a lot of people have because, as Mike mentioned earlier, it is something that is known, right? It's you see it and you have to deal with it, and maybe that's a little different than some of the other offsets from energy. So what kind of horizon and breakthroughs are there on the waste front that people should know about?
Sure. Well, you know, obviously with all things mining, you have to deal with all points of the life cycle, whether it's reclaiming a site or dealing with nuclear spent fuel. So our technical advisor, WMC Energy, was asked that question once with me, and his response to that was quite interesting. He said, no one's ever died from spent fuel rods. When you think about the deaths that happen in coal mining, oil and gas, et cetera, it is safely stored. Nobody wants it in their backyard, and it's not put in, you know, close to big populations. So it is safely stored. It does rest there for very long periods of time, and the radioactivity levels of it decay very quickly in the first 5 to 10 years. So yes, we need to find safe ways to store it, but I think we all have to look at the trade-offs with other forms of energy production. You know, for example, coal. I think most people would be shocked to know that in the United States, which is a very, you know, one of the wealthiest countries in the world, 19% of its electricity still comes from coal. When I think of coal, I think of people in horse and buggies 100 years ago. It's still a huge part of the energy mix. In China, coal has come down from 70%. It's still 57%. And we all know they have major pollution issues there. So China has really figured out that they need to build a much bigger fleet of reactors to deal with their coal issue. And that's exactly what they're doing.
You don't have to be a rocket scientist to help realize a mission to Mars. Become an agent of innovation with Invesco QQQ. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Okay, so Michael, China's the world's biggest polluter, right? And where are they at in this reactor conversation? And what will those reactors actually look like?
Sure. So just to one more point on the waste, is the solar panels last, you know, 20, 25 years, but we're seeing they last a little bit less. And you're coming up to really your first big period where you see the expiry of the useful life. And one of the things with solar panels is they go into the general electronic waste stream. And there you have nickel, lead, chromium, cadmium, all of these really toxic chemicals that are just sitting out there. So that's a real issue that I don't think gets enough attention to that. Regarding China, and you know, they have put forth by 2060, they want to decarbonize. And going back, though, if you go back to the middle 2005 timeframe, they were generating 6-7 gigawatts of electricity, and they made 7 or 8 nuclear reactors. You fast forward to today, they have over 50 nuclear reactors. So in 15 years, they've gone on a major spree. And if you look at most of the growth of nuclear power, two-thirds of that is coming out of China. They're putting forward a big wind and solar effort. The problem you have when you do that is, where is it generated? It's generated along the coast, and then you have to transport it into the mainland, and you lose a lot of the electricity that takes place. So China's nuclear program is one where it is a little over 50 gigawatts of electricity today. And you can see that by 2030 at 130 gigawatts of electricity. And then they continue to keep growing, and they plan on keep growing and growing. They could build anywhere from 10 to 12 reactors per year. And it's something that's a very significant program for them. And it's still a single digit percentage of their electricity generation. But it does provide clean baseload power to millions of people every time you build a reactor. So they're very, very committed to it. They're a major driver of the cycle.
Okay, Mike, I got to ask you, because this has been a really fascinating conversation, but effectively, you run a uranium hedge fund. Is that right?
Correct.
Okay, so I got to ask, like, what's it like to basically, like, be a character in, like, a James Bond movie every day?
It's definitely interesting to meet some interesting characters around the world, I'll say that.
Can I just get a sense of, like, some of the interesting characters that you encounter? Are they from a James Bond film?
I just say that my Russian and Kazakh need improvement. I need to speak better Russian and Kazakh.
You've probably had some good vodka.
Yeah. Yes.
That's the perk to that job. Okay. Two quickies. I want to wrap here. First on Tim, you know, we've seen a couple ETFs go from like nothing, like Oblivion, we call it Oblivion, and just shoot up. It's almost like when an indie movie hits the big time, like Blair Witch Project. It happened to Jets. It happened to Cathie Wood, I would say. And, you know, URNM is one of these funds that really, you know, all the odds stacked against you. And now it's well over $500 million. It's now trading about 80 million a day. I looked this time last year, between you and URA, you're trading 200 million a day. Last year on this day, you guys traded about 2 million a day. I mean, it's 100 times increase. I mean, what's that like when it finally hits?
It's surreal. My wife was joking. Like a year ago, I was saying, I just want to get to 50 million. You know, I just wanted to get to break even. But, you know, I don't know who said it, but good things happen to cheap assets. And I've been a huge believer in this thesis that Mike laid out. It just felt like at some point people would get the story, and we just kind of had to keep telling it. And the vehicle felt right. And listen, I think the single best part of this experience has been the money that we've made for people who invested in the fund, right? And a lot of our growth has been a result of performance. Right. It was that the index was constructed correctly. You know, thankfully for us, we decided to keep the Sprott vehicle in when our competitors chose to have it leave when they did the reorganization from UPC into Sprott. I think that's been a big differentiator. But yeah, it's been fun. I mean, it's been fascinating to watch some of these guys. And I always have had Jets in the back of my mind, you know. Maybe that could happen to us, but yeah, it's been fascinating.
Okay, last question. Tim, this is something we do on every episode. Tim, what is your favorite ETF ticker that is not your own?
I really like the Meta ETF, Matt Ball's Metaverse ETF. I wanted to launch that product so badly. And when they I think the guys at Roundhill have just been so good and so forward thinking about their tickers and their ideas. That's my favorite right now.
Okay, Mike, what's your favorite ticker that's not Tim's?
God, you know, Joel, I don't repeat this. I don't pay attention.
Okay, all right.
I am so engrossed in uranium and energy that I just I'm the wrong guy to ask.
Okay,
sorry, you're excused. You have some Kazakhstans to have vodka with. Okay, you're busy.
Yeah, yeah. And John, how about yours?
Well, we like having physical commodity funds, and we like to pair them with mining funds. So I'm going to say URNM for pairing with U.U.
Okay, we'll let you get away with it. All right.
Yeah, Tim, technically broke the rules there, but
it's okay.
It's all right. You guys are uranium heads. What can you? I mean, it's Tim.
It's what you're going to get.
That question normally would be most applicable to Tim, and I think he answered it. We were satisfied with that.
All right, Tim. Michael, John, thank you so much for joining us on Trillion.
Thanks for having us,
guys.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks for listening to Trillions. Until next time, you can find us on the Bloomberg Terminal, Bloomberg.com, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever else you like to listen. We'd love to hear from you. We're on Twitter. I'm at Joel Weber Show. He's at Eric Balchunas. This episode of Trillions was produced by Magnus Hendrickson. Francesca Levy is the head of Bloomberg Podcast. Bye.
You don't have to be a rocket scientist to help realize a mission to Mars. Become an agent of innovation with Invesco QQQ. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets
and help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take and Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.